Good morning from Uncle Don, here again to read the comics to Prince George. Lots of stuff to cover today, some funny, some serious, some weird. This is CFUR, Canada's favorite university radio at 88.7, and today is the 6th of August, 2002. Does the 6th of August mean anything to you? Any history majors out there? 57 years ago today, there was a terrorist bombing that killed over 200,000 people. This was the first of only two uses so far of the ultimate weapons of terror, nuclear bombs. Both were used by the United States of America against its destitute enemy, Japan, at the close of the Second World War. Japan had been beaten in all but name. The Japanese army had been routed everywhere but on its home islands. The Imperial Navy was at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. The Japanese air defenses were destroyed, and the American Air Force had unchallenged mastery of the skies. The Japanese government was suing for peace, and the only condition they asked for was the preservation of their emperor. The Americans demanded unconditional surrender. The Americans later claimed that it was necessary to use these two bombs against Hiroshima and Nagasaki to save the American lives that would have been lost in an invasion of Japan's home islands. If the Americans had invaded with their army, estimates ranged in the order of 1 million soldiers would have been killed. But that argument is specious. There was no call for an invasion to achieve victory. Since Japan was isolated and without any offensive military capabilities, it was rendered harmless. An indication of that helplessness was that the atomic bomb was delivered to Hiroshima by a single bomber without fighter escort. If Japan had been quarantined, it would have had to admit a defeat in time with no loss of American lives. The islands were short of food, and without imported oil, the economy was moribund. But there was a cloud on the horizon as far as President Truman was concerned. The Cold War with Russia had already started, and the atomic bombs were used more to intimidate these former allies than to defeat the Japanese. Stalin, the dictator of the Soviet Union, had agreed to declare war on Japan once the Germans were defeated. True to his word, he did commit his country to the defeat of Japan that very August. Truman and his Cold Warriors were afraid that the entry of the Soviet Union into the Pacific War would mean that the U.S. would have to share power over the defeated Japan once the war ended. This was nightmare for them, so they chose to defeat Japan before the Soviet Union could become actively involved. This was the reason behind these terror bombings. It is ironic that the peace terms were essentially the same as the Japanese had been asking for, and they were allowed to keep their emperor. Such is politics. The United States had been working for years on the development of the atomic bomb. It was a vast project of the highest priority with the highest level of security. The code name for this was the Manhattan Project, not to be confused with Al-Qaeda's own Manhattan Project. During the war, my father was in the U.S. Navy. Toward the end of the war, he was assigned to a General Electric plant in New Jersey, supervising production of war materiel. He told me that every project had a priority rating, with most of the effort going into material needed for the D-Day invasion of Europe. There was only one priority higher, the super-secret Manhattan Project. Anything labeled Manhattan Project went to the head of the queue when it came to material and production scheduling. Many people had a hand in this project, but few knew what the final product was. When he heard the announcement of the dropping of the bomb on the 6th of August, he said, "That's the Manhattan Project." Even that first announcement by Harry Truman was cloaked in a lie, as he told the American people that Hiroshima was a military base. There were military there, as in every Japanese city, but it was not a major military center. And most of the 200,000 people killed that day were civilians. How's that for terrorism and the use of weapons of mass destruction? It's a beautiful day in Prince George, with a temperature of balmy 291 Kelvin and a gentle breeze from the southwest at 17 furlongs per fortnight. There's a possibility of precipitation today of up to 3/1000ths of an L. Sorry, the good folks in the control room are looking confused. Did my obsolete and esoteric units of measurement confuse you? Well, before you bitched Uncle Don about it, I only want to hear from people who do not express their vehicle's fuel economy in miles per gallon. Now it is my turn to be confused. I've never bought a gallon of gasoline for my truck. I've never driven it a mile. We gave up those units in the 70s and left them to the Yanks to wrestle with. Get on board. This is the 21st century. Bloody troglodytes. I want to thank the Prince George Public Interest Group, located just around the corner from our studio here at UNBC, for providing some of the research materials upon which I have drawn for this and past shows. For anyone interested in alternative research materials, visit the PG Perg and check out their library. They are a real asset to the university and the community. For those who have not heard, I have invited Son of a Bush up here to Prince George for a debate interview with me on this coming 11th of September. Still no word from the White House on my invitation. You don't suppose he is afraid to go on the air with me, do you? Perhaps his handlers have told him to shut up, since every time he opens his mouth, the stock market drops. Maybe Wall Street cannot afford to have him talk on CFUR. I want to urge everyone out there to bring to my attention items that need to be aired publicly. Either mail your material to Uncle Don, care of CFUR, 3333 University Way, Prince George, V2N4Z9, or slip it under the door of our spacious studio in the Agora at the UNBC. There are a lot of things happening out there that people do not want us to know about, and I want to get them on the air. There have been a couple of items brought to my attention by this means, and I want to air one right now. You may know that the university administration has made a secret deal with Pepsi to install their brands of soft drinks, juices, and even water on the university campus, and there is no competing brands allowed. Now, you can buy a bottle of Pepsi-Cola sugar water from machines here for $1.25 each. At Costco, I see that they can sell a competing brand from a machine for $0.50. No wonder Pepsi can afford to give a large amount of money to the university for exclusive rights to milk the students, faculty, and staff here. Now, it has been no secret that this payment has been made for exclusivity, but there are other terms that have only come to my attention through receipt from an anonymous source of a photocopy of a portion of this lengthy agreement. There are other conditions attached to this money offered by this multinational monstrosity and rotter of children's teeth. One condition is that the official colors of the university are to be quietly changed from red and gold to blue and gold, and not just any blue, but the particular shade that Pepsi has been trying to patent as a trademark. It seems that the shade of red originally chosen by the founders of the university is too close to that which is familiar in the Coca-Cola logo. The change is being made by stealth. Compare a copy of the university calendar last year with the one for 2002 and 3, and you will see the change in the opening pages. As with George Orwell's 1984, it will be officially forgotten that the colors have changed. What the hell, not a handful of members of the university community ever knew what the colors were anyway. Everything points to our having a new prime minister thrust upon us. That's democracy. No one asks us, but a convention of folks who represent big money will be deciding which millionaire will sit in the privileged chair in the House of Commons. The candidates are extorting campaign funds now from their respective rich supporters to finance a run at the job. But that begs the question as to why so much money is needed by a person who wants to lead the Liberal Party. How much does it cost to print signs and buttons? Can't the convention delegates decide the best candidate based on his or her platform and political record? Don't they know what these people stand for? No. Convention delegates need to be plied with liquor and hospitality suites. The candidates have to travel to the ridings, twist arms, and make promises of spoils to be divided in case of victory. In this process, there is one little thing lacking, the wishes of the average people. The insiders of all major parties choose who will lead the parties, and we are given a choice between these pre-selected front men or women. We usually hold our noses and vote for the least bad candidates. But no one gives a damn about us after the votes are counted. After the selection of victors, there are rewards to be distributed and appointments to be made. That's democracy in action. Brian Mulroney and Jean Chrétien are a couple of slippery characters. Mulroney saddled us with a free trade agreement and the GST. Chrétien promised to get rid of the GST and not sign NAFTA without major revisions. He honored neither pledge. Now we have another slippery character in the person of Paul Martin, who made his reputation as a miracle worker by balancing the federal budget while Minister of Finance. We seldom hear about who paid for this balanced budget. Well, for one thing, Paul Martin cut transfers of tax money that the federal government had been sharing with the provincial governments. This has caused the provincial governments to either raise their taxes or cut education, health, and other customary services to people. Paul Martin cut benefits for unemployment insurance while collecting the massive revenue from payrolls that was supposed to provide some security for people who lost their jobs. That, again, fell on people, real working people. We've all heard about structural adjustment programs that the IMF has been foisting into third world governments as a price of granting loans. Recipients are forced to sell public enterprises, deregulate essential services, cut social spending, liberalize trade, free foreign investment of restrictions, and reorient the economy in favor of export production. Boy, are we Canadians lucky that we're not a third world country subject to such draconian measures. Oh yeah? Check that list and you will see a blueprint for what Martin has been dumping on us. We did not even have the IMF to force us into this laundry list of anti-democratic gifts to corporations. What is his excuse? Can he say that he was just implementing Chrétien's policies? Maybe so, but no one had a gun to his head. If and when we get this guy as Prime Minister, watch for an acceleration of the dismantling of Canadian society and government. As Prime Minister, Paul Martin will have immense power. Just imagine being able to destroy anyone you don't like with a stroke of a pen. That's power. It's enough to make a body giddy. Under the terms of Bill C-36, rammed through Parliament last year after the demise of the World Trade Center, the government can declare anyone, Canadian citizen or no, to be a terrorist or terrorist supporter. No hearing is necessary and no evidence need be produced. It then becomes illegal for anyone to have financial dealings with the accused, and his assets can be frozen. This has already happened, according to the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. Liban Hussein, a naturalized citizen, was said to have had terrorist connections, an accusation based solely on American information. His business here was destroyed, his assets frozen, and he was financially ruined. Later, the government dropped all legal proceedings, and he was left destitute. So sorry. Is this the type of power that characterizes a democracy? But hey, this is just a small part of one of the bills rammed through Parliament in the wake of the American panic over their involuntary urban renewal in September. We now have a list that reads like a bingo card. Under the C, 36. Under the C, 22. Under the C, 35. Under the C, 42. Bingo! The content of these bills constitutes a web of restrictions on citizens and enlargement of the powers of government, all in the name of fighting some terrorist boogeyman. The summer edition of Discourse and Disclosure, a quarterly newspaper from Nova Scotia available at PIRG, contains an article by a constitutional lawyer. This article examines the legal ramifications of the above bills, and it is scary stuff. The definition of terrorism has been broadened to include almost any form of protest, even such things as boycotts. You can be guilty of, quote, facilitating terrorism, unquote, by supplying goods or services to a terrorist even without your knowledge. The example used for this is the guy who mailed the anthrax. Under this law, the merchant down the street who sold him these stamps and envelopes is a facilitator and could be prosecuted. Now you can be arrested on suspicion and held for 72 hours. You can then be released and rearrested on the jailhouse steps for another 72 hours and again, without limit. Does this sound like the old South Africa yet? If you are questioned, U.S. must answer all questions, as refusal is a separate criminal act. They say your answers cannot be used against you, but they can be the basis for investigations that will uncover related material that which can be used against you. This is an engineered catch-22 trap for anyone, guilty or innocent. A person charged with terrorism is not entitled to see the evidence against him. His lawyer will have to defend him from unknown evidence given by unnamed people. How can one fight back? This system smacks of the communist justice system that we have ridiculed for so long. The judge is the prosecutor. The evidence is secret because of national security. Ministers can declare military security zones and declare martial law within them. No recourse. Lawyers are required to breach confidentiality and report on their clients. We have here the blueprint and enabling legislation for establishment of a police state on the old Eastern European model. How far will we let them go before we revolt and demand the restoration of our charter freedoms? My guess is that the government is waiting for a precipitating event that will allow them to test these laws under the cover of a perceived emergency. As I have said, hang on for a rough ride. This is CFUR, as in Corporations FU Radio, at 88.7 in Prince George, and this is Uncle Don reading the comics. We are living in a rapidly changing world. This we can all agree upon. From this point, opinions diverge drastically. Why should they? We all live in the same world. Every one of the 6 billion people in this world has unique sensory organs, a different brain, and a different personal environment. Better to ask why any of us agree on anything. Plato said that our perceptions of reality are like trying to make sense of the world by watching the shadows on the wall of a cave. I would add that our feeble attempts to forecast the future are like watching Plato's shadows in a rearview mirror. This comes to mind when I hear pundits predicting where the stock markets are heading. History is a blunt and uncertain instrument for looking ahead. We require a certain critical mass of information before we can make sense of anything. I cannot make any sense of baseball because I don't follow the sport, and the only information that intrudes itself into my consciousness is the odd score I hear on the radio. I lack the critical element of attention since I also lack concern. It's not part of my life. Before I can understand baseball, I have to know what the rules are, what teams are in the leagues, and when the games are played. I also need a basic understanding of the history of the sport. Each bit of information is like a piece of a jigsaw puzzle. There comes a critical point where there are enough pieces to form a pattern and the game begins to make sense. At that point, the news on the radio or the game on television becomes coherent and I can understand. Carry that image over to the world political situation. Most people, I would venture to say, don't know the basic geography of the planet, our history, who the players are, and who plays by what rules. Without enough basic knowledge, there are not enough pieces of the puzzle for us to perceive a pattern. The day's news of wars, floods, revolutions, and political maneuvering all become just noise. That is unfortunate since we live in a purported democracy. We can all vote to determine the direction of our society. If we don't know where we are or where we have been, how can we vote on where we are going and who is to take us there? I came out of university with a degree and a realization that I didn't understand what was going on with one of the most important issues of the day, the Vietnam War. I'd been too busy for years trying to master the splintered knowledge that was served up in various courses, some 40 of them, that constituted required hurdles toward getting that coveted piece of paper. But I had not been able to assemble all that information into a pattern that made sense. I took a year off before grad school with a laboring job. I made a project of finding as much as I could about the war. I read books, followed leads, and read all the periodicals I could find. Gradually a pattern began to form. When I had enough of the pieces of the puzzle to determine the pattern, that must have been the point where I became truly cynical about American politics. Before we can find the pieces of the puzzle for any issue, we have to sort out the false pieces. In any important issue, there are interested parties who put a lot of effort and money into molding public opinion. There are many public relations companies willing and able to make a buck by telling you what to think on behalf of an interested party. Public relations, of course, is a weasel term for propaganda. Propaganda is big business. Now that the United States is planning to launch an attack on Iraq and making no secret of it, we should all be trying to make sense of this situation. When it comes, none of us will be spared the effects. Just as we are suffering from spin-offs from the American War on Terror, so will we be affected by the advent of Persian Gulf War, Take Two. So we have to sift the information from the television, radio, and newspapers, right? And where will that information be coming from? Some will be produced by the newly named Office of Global Communications, an instrument of American propaganda directly reporting to my old friend, Son of a Bush. A spokesman for the new office made the statement that it will not spread disinformation. I love to hate that word. This new office will dispense to the unwashed information about what America really stands for. Here's another clumsy effort by George Bush to mold the world into what he wants it to be. Son of a Bush may believe the United States is the best of all worlds with freedom for all and universal prosperity. And so it is for his social class. People who have not seen the underside of that society with its massive prisons, city ghettos, its desperate poor millions with no jobs, poor education, no medical insurance, and no hope for any future may believe the image projected by television and the movies. A State Department spokesman said, I think it's been glaring to all of us that there are clear misunderstandings about our culture, about our society, and indeed about our foreign policies. Well, spokesman, tell me about how I misunderstand your culture of guns, fundamentalist nonsense, imprisonment, racism, and vacuous consumerism. Tell me how I misunderstand your foreign policies. I must think that you attacked Afghanistan because one man was supposed to be hiding there. I must think that you destroyed their society, however bad that might have been in our eyes, and replaced it with a similar one at the price of thousands of innocent lives. I must think that you invaded Panama, Nicaragua, Grenada, Vietnam, Iraq, without regard to international law or the United Nations. I must think that you will dump on your closest allies by strangling their exports and then killing their soldiers who are fighting your war for you without so much as an apology. Boy, I cannot wait for the Office of Global Communications to straighten out my screwy thinking. On the same page of the paper that revealed the existence of the Office of Global Communications, there's an article about bombings in Afghanistan. It seems the Canadians are not the only ones to doubt that the precision bombing is all it's cracked up to be. The jet jockeys who killed our soldiers there have developed a reputation for being trigger happy. They have been treated to a number of reports of bombings of civilian targets that cannot be justified by any military necessity. There was that caravan of Northern Alliance supporters and at least two wedding parties that we know of. In a land where reporters are scarce outside of Kabul, I have no doubt that there are many more incidents known only to the next of kin. The last bombing I have heard of killed some 48 members of a wedding party. Pretty impressive. Of course, the military spin doctors come out to explain that the collateral damage is deeply regretted, but the high-tech junk that the Americans have deployed fails to tell the difference between celebratory fire from rifles and anti-aircraft fire. Sorry, but I don't buy that one. What all of this does reveal is that there is more effort being given to covering up incidents of massacres from the air than there is to preventing them. Too much heavy stuff in the papers. I was recently told by the program manager here at CFUR, College Friendly University Radio 88.7, that there is another volunteer who intends to begin presenting it to a talk show this month. This fellow intends to come on with commentary from the right of Uncle Don. That figures. There are damn few people to my left in Prince George. I am an unrepentant socialist, a rare breed now. I believe that I have opened myself to public criticism by going on the air with my rants. By the same token, I believe that my new compadre will likewise be so open, and I will take every opportunity to challenge his statements and assumptions on this show. I'm really looking forward to this. Since the 70s, when the Trilateral Commission declared that there was a crisis of democracy, there has been a revolt of the rich and powerful against the growing power of the lower classes. This power of the lower classes was a result of the victory of the Allies in World War II. Citizens of the victorious countries actually believed the wartime propaganda that had stressed that the war was between fascism and democracy. Democracy had won, and now the people wanted the spoils of that war. They wanted to have some control of their workplaces democratically. They wanted a social safety net to protect them from the horrors they had experienced during the Depression. They wanted full employment. They wanted a government that represented them and not the elite. They wanted some of the fruits of the capitalism that had worked so well to produce the weapons of war. The elites had allowed this encroachment into their power and wealth since the Cold War demanded that the West present a progressive face to the Third World. Non-aligned countries were swaying between the models of development offered by the Soviet Union and the West. By the 70s, the Western elite sensed that the Cold War was largely won by the West and that the friendly facade could be dropped. This trilateral commission, led by one of the Rockefeller clan, determined that this excess of democracy was encroaching too far into the privileges of the rich. This commission was composed of the elites of North America, Western Europe, and Japan, hence the name Trilateral. As part of their battle plan, the Trilateral Commission spawned a number of think tanks as agents in spreading an anti-democratic propaganda net over society. Here in Canada, we can trace the birth of the Fraser Institute, the C.D. Howe Institute, and the Business Council on National Issues to the Trilateral Commission's declaration of war on popular democracy. These front groups have had huge infusions of cash from the corporations that profit so richly from monopoly capitalism. The successor of the late Business Council on National Issues is now composed of the chief executive officers of the largest corporations in Canada. You can hear their mouthpieces quoted in newscasts, pontificating on what is best for Canada. These front organizations have been quite successful in convincing the Canadian people that the national interest is congruent with the interests of corporations. The late Social Credit Party was a front for the corporations and the rich under the guise of acting for the little guy. Now we have the Liberal Party of BC that is serving the interests of the rich under the banner of a new era of prosperity. The federal Liberal and Conservative parties make no bones about acting on behalf of the rich. If you think that the GST and the various free trade treaties are in your best interest, I want to inform you that the Jolly Time Bingo is having a double dip special this morning. Don't miss it. Off you go. In the last provincial election, we heard a lot about the special interests that were feeding at the public trough. These special interests included unions, seniors, teachers, public servants, lawyers, doctors, farmers, loggers, nurses, hospital workers, the unemployed, the disabled, the sick, the students, etc., etc. Funny thing is, when you add up the special interests, it includes all of us except for the big businesses and the rich. It seems that corporations, with their tax breaks, phony bookkeeping, massive firing of workers, fat government contracts, and overpaid executives, are not special interests, but the engines of the country's prosperity. Well, the NDP of British Columbia blew their mandate and handed power to the corporate stooges. The Liberal government is now engaged in a campaign to convince the people of British Columbia that governments are not fit to run a peanut stand, and everything should be given to private corporations to run. Unfortunately, under the Liberals, this seems to have some merit, as they do seem quite unfit to run anything. For decades, we have had BC Hydro supplying us with reliable and cheap electric power. Now we're being assaulted with a propaganda campaign to convince us that we have to be globally competitive and sell our power corporation, probably to an American corporation. They admit that this will drastically increase our rates for electricity. We'll have to match export prices, or the new owners will simply sell our power across the border for bigger bucks and leave us in the dark. So why on earth should we change the status quo? Have these government stooges never heard of the expression, "If it isn't broken, don't fix it"? No, they have an ideological commitment. I don't know which is more frightening, the idea that these stooges believe that we will be better off with corporations running everything, or that they are laughing up their sleeves while dreaming of the rewards awaiting them on corporate boards when they are finally turfed out of office. By the time we get rid of these jerks, we may have irrevocably lost our power company, our insurance company, our best highways, our parks, our schools, our universities and colleges, our ferries, and everything else that has made British Columbia a pleasant place to live. And under the terms of NAFTA, we cannot get these public assets back once they are sold. My friends, we have been set up for a good screwing. Stay tuned. When I arrived in Australia in 1970, I took a job in Sydney with the Department of External Territories. I worked as a storeman in a warehouse that received goods and reshipped them to Papua New Guinea, which was then a UN trust territory of Australia's. A couple of months of that gave me a chance to get my bearings and a desire to see where all that stuff was going. I obtained a list of companies working in the territory and started some inquiries. I was hired by a construction company that was doing subcontracting work for Bechtel Corporation. They were developing a copper mine in Panguna on the island of Bougainville. Bougainville is the northernmost of the Solomon Islands, but they are politically part of Papua New Guinea. They had discovered a mountain that tested at 0.5% copper, and the plan was to ship that entire mountain to Japan for smelting. The mountain would be stripped from the top down, ground into powder, mixed with water to make a slurry, and piped to the coast, where it would be dried and loaded onto freighters. The company I worked for was building the power plant that would provide the electricity for the operation. The power plant was on the shore so that it could use seawater for cooling. I was flown into a small airport to be greeted by a perfect double rainbow following the usual afternoon rains. I found that it was perpetually hot and the flies were ubiquitous, day and night. I was put on the night shift at the warehouse that received, stored, and issued a bewildering array of pipe fittings, welding supplies, and such. I worked from 7 to 7, 6 days a week. Our living area was composed of a group of ATCO-type trailers in what had been a coconut plantation. The tall trees were still there, and they provided shade and entertainment as they occasionally loosed a huge fruit that would scare the hell out of us. I envisioned dying an ignominious death by a coconut. We had a beautiful little bay protected by a coral reef next to our compound, and the swimming was perfect when we had the time. We had local natives working with us who were called indigenes at the insistence of the Australian authorities. If anyone used any derogatory racial name for them, it was grounds for immediate dismissal and deportation. They were at great pains to avoid any taint of racism. We were, in turn, called expatriates. Euphemisms, eh? The Australian government required that the companies hire a quota of locals to supplement the imported expatriates. The social disruptions caused by this taught me some serious lessons in messing with foreign cultures. The Bougainvillean natives, I can now use that word, were a hunting-gathering society that was barely out of the Stone Age when World War II saw their island as the site of some serious battles between the Americans and the Japanese. When the Australians established the terms for the mining project, their intent was to develop a native labor force by integrating them into the building of the mine infrastructure. They would then learn the skills necessary to provide local labor for the mine when it got running. As it worked out, we screwed up their whole society. We took a society that respected age and wisdom and undermined it by hiring the young men and giving them more money than anyone there had seen before, although it was a small fraction of what the foreigners were paid. The local economy had it for all of this money. Some of it went to a small village of Chinese shops where they could buy electronics and cheap clothing, but the bulk of the money was spent at the company-run beer halls. Now the foreign workers could drink their beer, but it was something to behold how the native kids drank. They were not used to cold drinks, so they would buy a flat of 24 stubbies, open them all, and leave them in the sun to grow warm and flat. Then they would light into them with both hands until they were all gone. While they could still sit, they were not finished. The passed out ones were left where they fell to recover in the fullness of time. So we not only undermined their society hierarchy, but we created a whole generation of alcoholics. I left before they fired up our creation, but I have a good idea of what happened then. The power plant was designed to burn bunker oil, a product that is barely refined from crude oil. The smokestack barely cleared the roof, so the smoke would settle through the jungle. The waste hot water was to be discharged into that beautiful bay where we swam in crystal clear water. So the land would be polluted by the smoke, destroying the crops, and the water would be thermally polluted, which would kill the coral and the fish that were the staple protein source. In all, we laid the groundwork for what is now probably a wasteland. But the joke was on the corporation, since a civil war has caused the shutdown of the mine for some years now. It seems that the local people were aware of enough of what was happening that they wanted a bigger piece of the action and, I suppose, an end to the destruction of their island. In any case, the mine is dead and the machinery rusting. Good on you, mates. I avoided the beer halls while there, and in 4.5 months raked in enough money to buy myself a new Volkswagen when I got back to California. I brought that car up here when I immigrated the second time and drove it for 17 years before it finally died a rusty death. This is the end of Uncle Don Reads the Comics for 6 August 2002. Goodbye, all. I guess that will take care of the little bastards for another week.